Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, filling in for the Trib's Jennifer Napier-Pierce. And on the program today, a good deal of politics. We'll be talking about the big turnout for Utah caucuses, as well as some of the voting hiccups and, of course, the results. Also, the president visits Cuba and Senator Ted Cruz thinks Utah's Mike Lee would make a good Supreme Court justice. And joining me in the studio, investigative reporter Matt Canham. Matt, thank you for being here this morning.
No problem.
Also with us today, government reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Columnist Paul Raleigh is also here in studio. Paul, thanks for being here today.
Good morning.
And you can also join this discussion. Which headlines grabbed your attention this week? Tweet your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk or put them in the comments section at sltrib.com. Or you can call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, the two of you covered Tuesday's presidential caucuses here in Utah, and it was kind of a zoo. Maybe we can first talk about the outcomes. Who were the big winners, and what were the margins? Matt, let's start with the Democrats, if we can. All it was kind right. of a landslide.
Yes, it was. And I don't think everyone really expected it to that level. Well, there wasn't a ton of polling, and so even though the polling said that Bernie Sanders had a lead, I don't think people expected it to be an 80% victory to 20% for Hillary Clinton. And it was in every single caucus meeting in the state. Clinton did not win a majority in any of them. The closest she got was in Oak City, which is a teeny town in Millard County, right, where Hillary Clinton got 2 votes and uncommitted got 3 votes for a total of 5 votes. That was the best she did. She lost uncommitted in Oak City, and that was her best outcome in the state.
Wow. You know, the Utah Democratic Party celebrated big participation, some newly registered voters. What were the numbers there? There were a lot of people who showed up.
There were a lot of people who showed up. It was about 80,000 people who went and caucused at these 90 locations. I went to Clayton Middle School, and when I got there about 15 minutes before the caucus was supposed to begin, and there were already hundreds of people lined up. Hmm. The party let people vote early because the lines were so big. And I went and talked to some people, and there was a celebratory atmosphere at the beginning because you had all these Democrats looking around saying, look how many Democrats there are in Utah. This is amazing. Isn't this, you know, our vote matters this time. Look what we're doing. And that line got bigger and bigger and bigger. Over the course of that night, almost 4,000 people voted at that one location. And it stretched, you know, quarter mile or longer, the line did. But as the night went on, that celebratory atmosphere kind of got replaced with some frustration. It got colder and rained and people were hungry and they didn't expect to be voting for 2.5 hours. They had to get home to take care of their kids. And some even gave up. So it started out as a party, kind of ended with some frustration.
Well, and there were some glitches on both sides, and I want to talk about that. But, you know, we mentioned the large voter participation, the number of people who turned up and who registered, who newly registered. In the Democratic caucus, you could be an independent, unaffiliated voter, show up, and still have your voice heard. Is that
correct? There was no restriction on who could show up. As long as you were going to be 18 by the November general election, you could vote in the Democratic caucus.
And so is this these are people who I guess are, you know, feeling the burn. They are for the large part because of the outcome. We can see that they were mostly Bernie Sanders supporters. They're not traditional Democrats. Is this something that will increase the ranks of the Democratic Party in Utah, or is this sort of an anomaly? I guess maybe I don't know. Paul Raleigh, if you want to address that one.
Well, I mean, obviously the large turnout was because of Bernie Sanders. Now, if that would help the Democrats if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, I don't know. But there is a great excitement over Bernie Sanders, as was shown. There's a parallel that I see between what happened Tuesday and what this excitement for Bernie Sanders, probably mostly, young people. I heard that a lot of the new voters were younger people and you know, just excited about the Sanders phenomenon. There's a parallel back to the early 70s when there was the big anti-Vietnam movement from the University of Utah, basically, and they swarmed the Democratic caucuses back then and pretty much ousted the establishment Democrats, caused a lot of turmoil within the Democratic Party then. I remember Calvin Rampton was the sitting governor, Democratic governor. He was in his third term, very popular governor. And when he nominated Don Holbrooke, the establishment candidate for the U.S. Senate, He was actually booed by the delegates. You know, a lot of the Vietnam protesters who had gotten to be delegates. There were even some of those guys who got elected to the legislature in the early 70s. They didn't last long. Once they got up there, they didn't know what they were doing. But I see this happening now, or the same kind of phenomenon with Bernie Sanders, which means that there's a lot of frustration among people who would lean Democrat normally.
I think maybe the challenge is, and Matt can vouch for this, you sort of saw this wave building when Bernie, his first rally, had something, they said 14,000 people there and about 5,000 people at the West High event. And I think, you know, you kind of saw this wave building. The challenge for the Democratic Party now is going to be, assuming Bernie Sanders doesn't get the nomination, because I think right now it looks like Hillary Clinton is most likely going to get it, do these people become disillusioned and drop out of politics because a lot of them haven't necessarily been involved in the past? Or is the party able to kind of keep them involved and bring them along and sort of use that momentum or that you know, idealism, I guess, to sort of build their grassroots? And that's a real challenge, because if you're coming into this for the first time as a Bernie Sanders supporter and you realize, oh, you know, you've got all this enthusiasm, and then you realize it didn't matter at the end of the day, you kind of get jaded and fall away from the political process a little bit. It's a natural tendency. So it'll be interesting to see if the party can figure out a way to try to keep those people involved and build on that.
Well, I went and talked to people on those lines, I heard there were a couple things that might give me a sense that they can keep some of these people in the fold. So one, you know, I think Robert's right, and it's not on the party as much as it's on Hillary Clinton to keep these people involved, to make sure that they feel like there's a place for them to go if Bernie Sanders ends up losing, as the delegate math right now kind of suggests. The other part is it depends on who the Republican is. When I talk to these people online, I talk to a 25-year-old named Sarah who has never voted, never cared about politics, saw the Republican field led by Donald Trump and started freaking out and said, I can't, you know, let that happen. I need to be part of something that stops that guy from getting the presidency. So she started researching the Democrats, and she is a big-time Bernie Sanders supporter. She feels that that Bernie is way more authentic than Hillary Clinton is, likes the issues. And I said, okay, well, if Bernie loses, who do you vote for? She's like, I am voting for Hillary. I'm going to volunteer for Hillary. We can't have, you know, Donald Trump as president. So there's a kind of a both sides of this scenario. I think a lot of that turnout was because there was something to choose on the Democratic side. And some of that turnout was driven by Donald Trump.
You know, flip side of that, if you've got time.
Of course, Paul Roger.
You've got all this anti-Trump rhetoric now in Utah, you know, with Mitt Romney and you know, saying anybody but Trump, we got to stop Trump and everything else. And, of course, that was, a big factor in the Cruz landslide on the Republican side. If Trump does get the nomination, I think there's a good chance that there will people will stay home, you know, who normally vote Republican, you know, even straight party ticket voters, and will just be so, you know, frustrated or disillusioned. I think that could hurt the Republicans on that side, on the down ticket Republicans as well.
Right, and that's a good point. There was a Dan Jones poll, I think, out last week that said that Trump would actually lose to Hillary in Utah, which would be astonishing, really. I mean, there hasn't been a Democrat who's won Utah since, I think, Lyndon Johnson. And so it would be astonishing for – it kind of shows the depth, I think, of the resentment or the opposition to Donald Trump. And so then you have a race like Mia Love's congressional race last year that was decided by a few thousand votes. Does that make the difference there? What about some of these House districts, these state legislative districts that were decided by a few dozen votes? If those Republicans stay home, if they start flipping, you know, if they start splitting tickets, does that make a difference down ticket for the Democrats? And it could be a momentum builder, I think, for that party.
That's Robert Gierke explaining. I'm wondering, Robert, you went to, I know, a couple of Republican locations during the caucuses, and I'm wondering if you spoke to anybody who did have strong feelings about you know, the current Republican frontrunner, Donald Trump, and how they would vote should he get the nomination.
Well, I think, and Matt can speak to this too, because he talked to a number of people who were in that position or were sort of wrestling with that decision. pretty much everybody I talked to at the Republican at these Republican caucuses were not necessarily Ted Cruz supporters. They were just like, we need to stop Donald Trump. There was one woman I spoke with who said she supported Cruz from the get-go because he's a constitutional conservative, sort of like Mike Lee is. And but you know, there was a young woman named Courtney Wall that I talked to, and she said normally she would have voted for John Kasich, but she was swayed by this argument that the Cruz people were putting out in the last days of the campaign, and it was sort of given a lot of fuel by Mitt Romney when he said that we need to stop Donald Trump and Ted Cruz is the guy that can do that. And Governor Herbert jumped on board. My colleague Lee Davidson went to Josh Romney's and Mitt Romney's caucus. Mitt wasn't there. Josh was. And Josh stood up and said, you know, a vote for John Kasich, unfortunately, is wasted at this point. We need to stop Donald Trump because he's, you know, this matters. This election matters, and we can't mess around.
Which was essentially the argument, I guess, that Governor Gary Herbert used when he endorsed the Ohio Governor John Kasich. Because for a long time, excuse me, not Ohio Governor John Kasich, he endorsed Ted Cruz, but when he didn't endorse Kasich, why was that decision made for that exact same reason?
Well, yeah, the governor actually spoke to this yesterday. He said that, you know, he thought that Ted Cruz was the guy that could actually win, and he thought that he was the best candidate with the best shot of winning. And he's concerned at some of the rhetoric in the campaign. This is what the governor said yesterday, and so he jumped on board with that, and you kind of saw it really take off. There was a poll that was done just a few days before the campaign that showed, I believe, Ted Cruz was at about 53%, and so, you know, and John Kasich was at about 30%. You saw the final results. You know, Cruz came in at close to 75%, and you had Kasich just plummet. So I think that, you know, there are probably a number of reasons for that, but I think probably the largest, and I spoke with Polster about this after the election, he said that probably the largest reason for that is people who were swayed by this argument that John Kasich can't win, and we can't let Donald Trump get a single delegate in Utah.
Well, for my part, I went to the Bryant Middle School in Salt Lake City, where there was a Republican caucus going on, and I spoke to a couple of voters in line who said that if Donald Trump got the election, they wouldn't stay. It's not that they would stay home. They would actually go out and vote for, you know, presumably Hillary Clinton or even Bernie Sanders should she get the nomination, because they were that upset with the party. But at the same time, I think that the party frontrunners, they're not getting the momentum out of Utah. I'm wondering if there's a change for the candidates that are, you know, if Cruz and Sanders are now going to have more of an advantage as they move forward. We're talking as though Hillary Clinton is the nominee at this point, but I'm wondering if that's actually decided.
So Hillary Clinton has about a 300 delegate lead. When Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton in 2008, the biggest delegate lead he ever had was 90. So 300 is a lot. In the states going forward, some of them do play well to Bernie Sanders. Bernie expects to do well in Alaska and Vermont. Alaska and Washington. He did well in Vermont, where he's from. But there are some states that don't play well for him. And all she has to do is ride this out. He has to change the game drastically. In the Democratic contest, every state awards the delegates proportionally, which means he has to start winning by 70% in states. Now, yeah, you can do that in Utah, but are you going to do that in California? You know, and that's where there's a big problem.
I think that one thing that his candidacy has done is if she wins, and I agree with Matt, I believe she's going to get the nomination, but she has to make sure, she has to ensure that she keeps those Bernie Sanders people. He's got her moving to the left a little bit. It might determine who she picks as her vice presidential running mate. Because who knows if these people get disillusioned and then don't vote themselves, that could hurt her in the general election.
On the other side of the ledger, on the delegate race, you've got Donald Trump's got about 739 of the 1,237 that he needs. They've got a break now where the next caucus or the next primary is in Wisconsin, and then they move into all these mid-Atlantic states. And that's going to be difficult – actually, northern Atlantic states. And that's going to be kind of difficult for a Ted Cruz to play well in those states. I mean, it's more of a natural fit for a Trump candidate. Also, a lot more of the Republican races now are going to be winner-take-all. So you really have to see Cruz make a big surge. Now, there's some time to do it. Like I said, there's just Wisconsin, and then the next – those – Atlantic states are about a month away. One of the people I spoke with yesterday was Craig Powell, and he was the state chairman for the Kasich campaign. And he said it probably would have been better for the party to have a strong Kasich running in states like Pennsylvania, which is right next to Ohio, and some of these Atlantic states that are more in Kasich's backyard, and he might appeal to the more moderate Republican sort of northeastern voters. But so that's a challenge. I mean, it's still all the best forecasts, I think, are saying it's going to be really close, really tight, whether Trump can actually get the nomination before the July convention. And it's going to come down to a dozen delegates or so. And that said, you know, everybody expected Cruz to win Utah. Everybody expected Trump to win Arizona. Neither of those contests really changed the dynamic of that race much.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here pretty quickly. But Robert, the 1,237 delegate mark that Trump needs, if he does get that mark, I mean, is he automatically the nominee?
There's a little bit of wiggle room probably going into the convention but the assumption is that a lot of states like Utah, the delegates are bound to vote for the winner of the contest on at least the first ballot. After that, you know, if he doesn't get the 1,237, then it's a free for all, and we haven't seen that in a long time, and it could be a very, very interesting contest.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break, but when we come back, I'd like to stick with this topic for just a bit longer, talk about the long lines, the online glitches, photocopied ballots, parking tickets even. Listeners, tweet your comments to the hashtag TribTalk, comment at sltrib.com, or call us at 801-355-TALK. We'll take a short break and return in a moment. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Logan Regional Hospital Nutrition Services, helping people live a healthier life through programs directed to prevent diabetes and heart disease. Information at loganregional.org.
Presidential candidates from both parties have criticized the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We're not going to be able to change everybody's minds, and that's not our goal. It's not what's necessary.
I'm Molly Wood. Passing the TPP through Congress is an uphill battle. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, filling in for the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, joined in studio by Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Paul Raleigh. I want to stick with the caucuses for just a little bit longer. There was big turnout on both sides, and there were some problems with the process here for both parties. Maybe we can start with the online voting system the Republicans had in place. What went wrong there, Robert Gerke?
Well, this was the first time they've tried it. And whenever you try to deploy technology, you're going to end up with a little bit of it's a dicey proposition, I guess. A lot of the problems that they experienced were that they sent out these PIN numbers people had to pre-register, and for some that wasn't clear that they had to do that in advance of the voting. And so a lot of people the day of the election, they were kind of trying to call the helpline and see if they could pre-register and, you know, that sort of thing. After you pre-registered, you get this PIN number, and the PIN number was this long sort of alphanumeric code that was case sensitive, and people had problems entering those in and doing it accurately. And then once you did that, the page was apparently sort of swamped and slow to load.
In some instances, this PIN was 30 characters long.
And then, you know, of course, it ends up in people's spam filters, as inevitably happens, or people see it and delete it and don't think about it, and then they have to reset their PIN. So there were some of those problems that I think are inevitable. I think that sometimes they they did exist. I don't think you can deny that they didn't happen. And there are glitches that they're going to have to work out and try to make this a little bit more accepted. In the end, I think it was about 25,000 people ended up voting online, which they had close to 30,000 register. The party put out some numbers yesterday after you filled out your ballot. It asked you, you know, are you satisfied? And overwhelmingly, people were satisfied and would like to see this continue. There, you know, and the other thing that they need to kind of probably put people's mind at ease on is the security issues. There were some Common Cause was raising issues about the security of voting online and so forth. And so, you know, this is the first time they've tried it. They did it to try to alleviate some of the crowding, I think, at the caucuses. Like, as we saw in the Democratic side, they had big turnout. They had record turnout at the Republican caucus too. They were going to say they were estimating close to 200,000 people, including those online votes.
Paul Raleigh, you wrote about this. The state GOP had been touting its online voting system because of challenges, kind of, to the caucus and convention system, or at least alternatives being put into place on that. Maybe you could talk about that for a moment. This is something you wrote about in a column this week.
Well, yeah, I mean, the GOP has been fighting the count my vote, the primary thing, and so yeah, they were touting that very much, you know, boasting about this, you know, you could, because one of the arguments, for the count my vote was, participation, and people couldn't always go to the caucuses and that sort of thing, and so you had, you know, smaller groups of people making decisions on delegates being chosen and that sort of thing, and one of the elements of the count my vote legislation was to make it easier for people to vote, like at the caucus or in the convention. So yeah, they were touting that quite a bit, and like Robert said, there were a number of glitches, but I think that possibly the Count My Vote petition and then subsequently the legislation that allows for an alternate path to the ballot through signature gathering has been pushing maybe the Republican Party this way to show that they're opening up and being more inclusive.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Paul hit it on the head. They're trying to demonstrate that they are inclusive and trying to, but it's kind of funny too, though, because if you're voting online, that's not a caucus. That's more of a primary. And also, if you look back at the last two primary elections we've had for a presidential primary, there have actually been more people coming out than came out to the caucus. So the argument that they were putting forward is like, look at us, we're being more inclusive, everybody can participate, we don't need to worry about count my vote in their direct primary thing. But on the flip side of that is, you know, this is more of a, they did implement something that was more like a primary, and in those primaries that we have had in the past, you still got better turnout.
Well, and primaries were, I guess, defunded at some point by the Utah State Legislature.
Right. The governor had proposed spending $3 million to hold the presidential primary this year. The Republican Party actually said, no, we don't want that. We would rather do the caucuses because, as Paul mentioned, they're trying to demonstrate that caucuses get this huge turnout, and they're going to, you know, that this is a viable, you know, invigorating process, I guess, and so they said, "Well, we don't need the money. Thanks." The Democrats actually wanted to do the primary, but with only one side doing it, the legislature wasn't going to fund it. They pulled it out. The governor said yesterday that he would like to see going forward. He would like to see us have primaries, and he would actually like to see broader than that, on a national level, four regional primaries. That way, each side kind of gets to go first. You don't have this New Hampshire, Iowa thing that we always end up dealing with, and everybody kind of gets a say and gets courted, I guess, by the candidates.
Sure. Well, that's something to unpack as well. But you know, we talked about online glitches on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side, meanwhile, there was an overwhelming turnout, and to the extent that they didn't have enough ballots on hand, Matt Canham, I've also received reports of a lot of parking tickets being given out during at some locations. I wonder if anybody else has heard that. But what were the problems on the Democratic side?
So the Democrats decided not to spend the $80,000 it would take to do an online ballot. They decided they want to spend that money in November on their campaigns. So they spent $20,000 to set up 90 locations to vote. Using the 2008 numbers, when about 132,000 people came out to vote for either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton in the primary then, they said maybe about half those people will show up to the caucus. So they printed 65,000 ballots. 80,000 people showed up. that caused chaos in certain places. Certain places that you might not expect. In Provo, they had nearly 4,000 people show up. They did not send 4,000 ballots to Provo. So what happened is people scrambled to find parking. They scrambled to find ballots. They scrambled to get pens to fill out the paper ballots. And it caused an already chaotic situation to last a little longer than it should have. The way it worked is if you were in line by 8:30, you got to vote. And but these were long central lines where you had to just wait your turn. And in Kearns at Beehive Elementary, the last people in line who got there at 8:30 didn't vote until 11 p.m.
Wow. That's remarkable. And you know, at caucus meetings, you know, there's more than just ballot voting right. going on. There are delegates being chosen. Was that delayed until 11 p.m. at that location?
You know, it wasn't. The way this worked was, I mean, which was some part of the frustration on the Democratic side, is on the Republican side, you voted for president, you voted for delegate in these smaller precinct meetings. We're talking 50 people, 100 people, and sometimes a little bit more. So it was more manageable. On the Democratic side, you voted for president by standing in the longest line you've probably seen since your last visit to Disneyland. And then outside of that, if you were lucky to be there and done in time to actually vote on who should be a delegate to the state convention, then you got to participate in that.
Well, and, you know, I think about just for a tiny bit of commentary, people who, you know, we mentioned that people who are 17 but will be 18 by the time right. of the general election were allowed to vote in this primary. For as a first voting experience, this is a unique, a kind of a tough one to be
well,
to have as an example.
I think for young people, it was a little bit more exciting. Just for our listeners who aren't as comfortable with the idea of what a caucus or a primary is.
Yeah.
A primary is a state-run election, so state election law matters. A caucus is not. It's run by the parties. They can do whatever they want within their rules. So under Democratic rules, you don't have to be a registered voter. You have to be an eligible voter, which is why a 17-year-old who's going to be 18 in November can vote. You're an eligible voter in the general election. The party gets to decide what happens. And so on the Democratic side, there was such a huge line. They just gave up on most of their rules. They started just handing out ballots, saying, fill it out and we'll figure it out later. So they haven't finished counting the ballots
right.
or certifying the results. And they're not going to until April 6th because of that chaotic situation. They now have to go ballot by ballot and say, is this an actual person? Does this person actually live at the address they put on there? Is their age correct? And did they vote in the right location? Okay, next one. Only 80,000 more ballots to check. You know, they're going to do each of this one at a time.
Sounds like an expensive prospect, actually. Robert Gerke, on the other side, are the Republicans done counting?
Well, so far what they've reported is 89% of the results. So, you know, they've got quite a ways to go, it looks like. In both contests, the outcome is decided. But, yeah, on you know, they're still working through it.
Well, we're talking about the contest to award delegates. There are these other delegates out there, the super delegates who don't have to go through this process. Choosing who to support based on, you know, probably people coming to them and talking to them, but not on voting at all. Talk about the super delegates. What are they and how do they make their choices?
So superdelegates are mostly a Democratic Party thing.
Right.
And superdelegates are party insiders awarded proportionally by your population and the number of Democratic voters you have in your state. And they are allowed to do whatever they want. Utah has four. And two of them, Patrice Arendt, who's a state representative, and Breanne Miller, who's the Democratic Vice Party chairwoman, the vice chairwoman of the party, have already said they're supporting Hillary Clinton no matter what. Peter Caroon, who's the chairman of the party, doesn't like the superdelegate process. He said he would just use his superdelegate vote to mirror whatever the state Democrats vote. So he's now a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Okay.
Wayne Holland is the national committee man, and he is the fourth superdelegate from the state of Utah, and he hasn't decided where he's going to go. And I guarantee he is getting hounded by Sanders and Clinton supporters nonstop for that vote. Hillary Clinton has captured by far the majority of superdelegates, which makes sense. These are party insiders. These are establishment figures. These are people who are naturally more inclined to go for someone like a Hillary Clinton than an outsider campaign like Bernie Sanders. But that they can change their mind at a moment's notice.
Paul Raleigh from the Opinion Desk, and I ask you, you know, what you think of the superdelegates in general, the concept of the superdelegate, use.
Well, it's always been controversial. I mean, you know, and it's, I mean, it's been in place for a long time. I'm not sure that I would say it's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, because they do represent, you know, kind of the establishment insider aspect of a political party, as opposed to like the, you know, you. All these people who came out to vote for Bernie Sanders, a lot of them are first-time voters. They're not really politically tuned in, and so, you know, maybe a small voice from the establishment, you know, insider part of the party is not a bad idea because they do have that history and that knowledge and that sort of thing.
I had to explain to my daughter the other day. She was asking why, you know, Bernie Sanders keeps doing well in these primaries and these caucuses and isn't winning the nomination. And I said, well, the Republicans or the Democrats have done a better job of fixing the process for the establishment candidate. And if Republicans had this same thing in place, we probably wouldn't have quite the hand-wringing and uproar over Donald Trump, because then the establishment could sort of articulate its, you know, or make its will known, I guess. You know, it's like Leonard Cohen said, everybody knows the fight is fixed, I guess. I mean, on the Republican side, they've got the two national committee members, Bruce Huff and Enid Mickelson, and then the state party chairman, James Evans. Those are the three that kind of get to play a similar role to the superdelegates of the national convention. And so, and right now they're kind of keeping their powder dry, I guess, or trying to keep their head down.
Which way the winds blow. We're talking about raucous caucuses here in the state of Utah. There was other news this week, of course, and joining us on the phone now to unpack some of it, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Thomas, are you there on the line?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning, Thomas. Thanks for joining us. We have, during this past, half hour or so, been talking about caucuses, and we mentioned that Texas Senator Ted Cruz was the winner here in Utah. During a visit to Utah in advance of those caucuses, he had an interesting suggestion on Utah Senator Mike Lee. Thomas, what was that suggestion?
You know, there's nothing better to butter up somebody who's endorsing you than to talk about a future job that you could have that they've always wanted. So Senator Ted Cruz, of course, is great buddies with Senator Mike Lee. And while he was in Utah, he mentioned that he thinks that Senator Mike Lee would be a great choice to be on the Supreme Court to fill a spot vacated by the late Antonin Scalia. Of course, there's a lot of things that can happen there, but Mike Lee has always been, you know, kind of wanting to be on the Supreme Court. He's one of those kids that, you know, some of us play football or baseball or collected stamps or something. Mike Lee, like, went to visit the Supreme Court with his father, who is the Solicitor General under President Reagan. So the idea that Ted Cruz becomes president and nominates Mike Lee to the Supreme Court, he tossed that out there. Of course, Mike Lee, I'm sure, very much likes that. There's a good question of whether the Senate, however, would confirm Mike Lee. We haven't had a senator become a justice in quite a while, and there's a reason for that, because you have to weigh in on various subjects. You're not necessarily you're known quantity. You're not necessarily somebody who, you're trying to read between the lines of an opinion before where they stand on sure. issues. This is obviously a conservative choice. Should Ted Cruz win the presidency, and should he nominate Mike Lee?
You've made your opinion known, I guess. This was at an event to kick off Mike Lee's campaign, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. And, there's no secret that Mike Lee is going to seek re-election. He's been working very hard at kind of winning back over some of the establishment part of Utah and the business community to some of the other, more high-profile Utahns, and try to pitch himself better as somebody who is more, still has the conservative side, but can also work with the business side and get things done for Utah, which was a concern a couple of years ago.
Paul Raleigh, you pointed out that Lee's refusal to meet with Merrick Garland, the president's nominee for the vacancy on the Supreme Court, is seen as sort of a conflict of interest when we're talking about Lee conceivably being nominated by Ted Cruz himself.
Well, it does lend fuel for cynics like me, because it is kind of interesting. He is one of the first of all. Let me say that I had a couple of thoughts about sure. About this whole thing, and one is, if Mike Lee were nominated, and put on the Supreme Court, he would be one of the most, one of the least experienced people ever put on the Supreme Court. You know, at least since Clarence Thomas, maybe. But so that's one thing. I mean, you have to question that on that pick. The other thing, I mean, it's one thing to like want to be a Supreme Court guy since you were 10 years old. I wanted to play center field in the, for the New York Yankees since I was 10 years old. But anyway, and then like I wrote about, he's part of one of the leading people who's talking about, you know, blocking this nomination and not even meeting with, not even considering it. And so if there's a chance or a consideration that he would be put on the Supreme Court, you got to look at that. You got to think, well, you know, here a guy is blocking it until he gets a chance to be put on himself. I mean, I'm not sure that there's anything that can be done about that, or are there any laws against it or anything else. But it does seem a little untoward, you know, that whole situation.
Wow. Hey, Thomas, has just out of curiosity, has Mike Lee, I'm imagining that Mike Lee has endorsed Senator Ted Cruz for the presidency?
Yes, he has.
Yeah. However, the rest of the Utah delegation, have they made much in the way of endorsements? And what will they do if Donald Trump gets the Republican nomination?
You know, so of course, everyone in the delegation except Mike Lee was at one point supporting Marco Rubio, who is no longer a candidate and probably, you know, maybe trying to come back and do his job in the Senate that he forgot about for a little while he was running for president. But now that is a good question, and it's one that they don't really want to answer necessarily if they will support a Donald Trump GOP nominee. Some are unequivocal. Congressman Chaffetz, when I asked him this question, he said he would support the nominee, and I said, even if that's Donald Trump, and he said, I will support the nominee, and kind of went like that with him repeating the line for about, you know, 2 minutes. That's as far as he was going to go. Congressman Milov, so she's not ready to answer that question yet. Representative Rob Bishop told me how great the weather was when I asked him the question. So he's not really ready to do that either. And when it comes down to Mike Lee, he's like, you know, his kind of line is Trump won't be the nominee, Ted Cruz will. So there's no reason to answer that question. But when pressed, he just says he needs more information, but he's not going to vote for Hillary. But it does put them all in a very tough spot, especially Congressman Lee Love, who could have a tough reelection campaign. And there's already a lot of concern about the down ballot impact of Donald Trump nomination. How does that affect, you know, people like Congressman Love, who are in a district facing, you know, voters who are not fans of the guy who may be leading the ticket, and that could really affect her situation. So she's got to play a pretty fine line here on, you know, how she's going to handle the potential of Donald Trump as the GOP standard bearer.
Well, we talked about the potential of Utah conceivably going blue for the first time in you know, however many, Paul, how long has it been since Utah has had a vote for a Democrat in the White House?
Well, like Robert said, the last time Utah voted for a Democrat was Lyndon Johnson in 64.
Years ago, yeah.
But this whole situation, I just wanted to point out, I mean, it has put these Republican office holders in a kind of a tough position. It's led to a very awkward statement by the other congressman, Chris Stewart, who was talking about that. And he basically, in so many words, said he would support Benito Mussolini if he were the Republican nominee, which, you know, was a pretty funny thing to say.
Well, it is. It's telling, I think, because you end up, these are the people who are, these are members of the party, lifelong members of the party. They live, breathe, and die politics. And the fact that they're now having probably some of them for the first time in their adult lives questioning their party allegiance because of the candidate that is on the brink or appears to be headed to winning the nomination is a really telling statement. And if these people are having those sort of second thoughts, and again, Matt talked to a lot of these people who were sort of weighing the same thing, you gotta wonder what the average voter's going through, the average voter's mind, who isn't quite as, you know, beholden or betrothed to their party.
Matt, yeah.
Yeah, we asked, the Tribune asked its readers to submit their thoughts on this, and we got more than 600 of them. And only a couple dozen were people who said they would support Trump because they liked his outsider appeal or that he didn't take cash from special interests. But for the majority of people, they were not enthused with this man. And it does. It really shakes people up to say, well, okay, you're not going to support the Republican nominee, so what are you going to do? The majority of them said they would look for a third-party candidate. Some of them said they would go for Hillary Clinton, and some of them said they would just stay home. But it's a real shock to the system. When you identify your political party, it becomes part of your identity and who you are. And for the first time in probably since Barry Goldwater, it's a legitimate question to ask a Republican, would you support Donald Trump if he was the nominee? That hasn't happened in multiple generations.
Well, and
let's think of the idea of a third party, which some people have been talking about. Gary Johnson's back out. He's running his campaign out of Salt Lake City, the former New Mexico governor, and he's talking about running again. Michael Bloomberg's already said he's not running. John Thompson said he's staying on the sidelines. But if you get to a situation where you have half the GOP saying they're not going to vote for their own nominee, there is a pretty big opening for a third-party candidate if he or she could actually, you know, get on the ballot in all 50 states.
And we talked a little bit about what happens at an open convention on a second ballot. Even there's this prospect, even if Trump does get the nomination on the first ballot, that 30-40% of the delegates could get up and walk out of the convention hall, you know, and that would be an absolute spectacle. And it would also just speak to the complete divide in the Republican Party that makes it very difficult to go in and win a general election in November against a pretty well-funded and you know, well-connected and experienced candidate in Hillary Clinton.
Well, and that's a question that I have is would you know, we talk about the split happening now and, you know, maybe at the brokered convention, but would the party? I mean, you wonder if the party base is motivated to vote for somebody like Ted Cruz if he is chosen as in the convention as the presidential nominee. Would it really be that divided? I guess that's the sort of a speculative question.
You mean if the party does get rid of Trump at the convention and rallies behind a Ted Cruz or
correct.
Something like that? Well, no, I don't know that the party's necessarily as divided over that. I mean, but you do have, I mean, Trump has won a lot of votes. He's won more votes than anybody else. He'll say that over and over. He's won more votes than anybody else in this primary process. He's brought a lot of new people to the process. Those people, much like we talked about with the Bernie Sanders people, would probably fall away. They're not going to go out and support a Ted Cruz, and they're not going to support a party where the establishment has done everything it could to try to quash the candidacy of the guy that they came out to support in the first place. So even if you do have somebody, a more establishment candidate emerging from the convention, you still have a clear division in the party with these people who, you know, by the thousands came out and supported Donald Trump.
Well, as this process goes on, I mean, it's almost gotten to the point of how outrageous can Donald Trump be before he finally, you know, goes over the line and makes himself completely unelectable. I mean, the latest one now is he's comparing his wife to Ted Cruz's wife, who's got the hottest babe wife. You know, that's what he said yesterday. I mean, at some point, and the Republican Party needs to worry about that, I think, in a general election. I mean, those comments are gonna resonate, and they're gonna come back. And at some point, I mean, you know, I think women still have the majority; they constitute the majority of voters in the United States. And how many offensive things can he say to women before he becomes totally unpalatable?
Well, and these things haven't come back to bite him, as you mentioned. And I'm wondering if, as he pivots in, you know, into the general election, if he, assuming that he, you know, he gets the nomination, is he going to become more and more dialed back, and will that, you know, more centrist?
Those comments are out there. And I'm sure that whoever his opponent is are going to make sure that they stay out there in a general election campaign.
Well, people have been saying that this is a toxic, you know, contentious election year. Senator Hatch even used the word toxic. And Tommy, since I've got you on the line, I'd like to ask you about this. Senator Hatch has, you know, is one of two senators, Lee and Hatch, who are thwarting the president's nomination for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. And I'm wondering. I'm wondering if there's been any changes in that. Have we seen any movement on the Supreme Court nomination?
No, and you're not really going to see any for a little while, though they're going to try to keep it out there. The one change has been there have been a few Republicans who kind of peeled away from this, you know, lockstep, we're not going to meet with Merrick Garland. So right now it could be, you know, the pressure could be on if there are a couple of Republicans who say, no, we should meet with him, we should hold hearings, we should at least have a vote, then you have a break in the dam of some sort, and it's going to be harder for Mitch McConnell to kind of hold them back, or Senator Grassley, who's also, you know, got a tough situation there. So the one possibility, Orrin Hatch is very much open to the idea of confirming a justice in a lame duck session after the election. GOP leaders are trying to tamp him down on that and say that's not the message we want to put out there. We don't want to say we're going to confirm him that Hillary wins or something like that. But, you know, this is just going to be a stalemate for a while. And Hatch and Lee don't seem to be moving whatsoever on the idea of any hearings in the next little while.
And Paul Raleigh, the idea here has been that the people would weigh in. I mean, a number of Republicans have been saying, let's let the people weigh in during the election. But the idea of a lame duck confirmation for Merrick Garland if a Democrat wins is something that you've written about this week as well.
Well, yeah, two thoughts. First of all, and Tommy, correct me if I'm wrong, but the senators now who are having second thoughts, the Republicans, and saying that maybe we can, you know, consider this and have a hearing, are Republican senators in swing states or who are up for reelection. And now they're worried about how this is going to offend, you know, it could hurt them in the election. And I mean, people like Hatch, I mean, he doesn't have to worry about it. But that's one thing. The other is Orrin Hatch seems to be, you know, twisting himself into knots on this thing. I mean, you know, he'll say on one hand, we should let the people decide, you know, in whoever picks the next president. And then in the next breath, he says, unless the next president is a Democrat, and then we'll go back to Obama's pick and won't let the people decide this year.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to ask you to just bear with me for a second. We've got to take a short break, but we will return in a moment and head to our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Adele smashed sales records with her album 25. Next time on Q, I'll chat with her about why making the record was so tough, how motherhood changed her as an artist, and staying grounded when you're the most talked about musician in the world. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Next on American Roots, it's Kingpins of the Gulf Coast with New Orleans' Dr. John, recalling his early days in R&B, soul, and the spirit world. Then Houston singer-songwriter Rodney Crowell talks about growing up on the rough side of town, making songs for Emmylou Harris and his ex, Roseanne Cash. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Join us Saturday night at 8 on Utah Public Radio.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, filling in for the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier Pierce. And right now it is time for our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, with just a couple of minutes to go. Matt Canham, do you have an underplayed story of the week?
Sure do. I thought it was very interesting that in the middle of all this talk, you have Donald Trump, who's not been very positive towards Muslims. Well, in Salt Lake City, the Planning Commission unanimously approved a new conditional use permit for the construction of a large mosque at 7th South and 7th East, and it got absolutely no opposition. Utah has a growing Muslim population because of immigrants.
Okay. Paul Raleigh, do you have one?
Yeah, I'll go. I wrote about this in my column, but while we've talked about the Republicans and Democrats not being totally prepared for the onslaught and the big crowds, one group that was prepared was the Salt Lake City parking enforcement people, and they seem to have a great instinct to know where the crowds are. At the caucus at Ensign School up on the avenues, people saw a parking enforcement guy after 8 o'clock giving tickets to people who are parked along the cemetery wall.
Wow. How about yourself, Robert Gerke?
Well, I think take a look at Nate Carlisle's story. But we've been talking a lot about the caucus today, and Nate did a story about the caucus in the polygamous town of Hilldale and the way that they're trying to sort of maintain some normalcy and be involved in the process while also being this sort of secluded, reclusive polygamous town. It's a good read. Take a gander.
We will take a look. Thomas Burr, I'm going to have you hold your underplayed story of the week because we are out of time. But I do want to say Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, Paul Raleigh, and Thomas Burr. Thank you all for joining me today on Behind the Headlines.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Jennifer talks to Kirby about home brewing.
Let's talk home brewing. And you talked about how your mom used to make you something called Mojave
Popsicle.
What in the world is Mojave Popsicle?
It's a root beer that my mom made herself, and it was like a weekend event. We would look for long neck beer bottles on the side of the road, come home, shake the cigarette butts out of them, wash them, get them sterilized, and then she would brew up this licorice smelling stuff. And she didn't use, you know, the flavors that they have today. She made it herself. And then she would pour it into these bottles, and we would cap it with this mechanical capper. And then that served as our root beer. This is while we were living down in the Mojave Desert. And I made some interesting discoveries along the way, specifically that the stuff you make yourself doesn't always stay the way you made it.
Yeah. Yeah. Things tend to ferment when they're left sitting. I love the first line of this column. It is, my mom was a bootlegger. That's great. Could you read some of this column?
Yeah. After we were done making it, they would put it in a closet, you know, in a warm closet. We'd drink the stuff over a period of months. Exactly when it stopped being root beer and started being illegal was a mystery. All we knew is at some point our floats began tasting like they'd been made with Colt 45, which was a malt liquor back then. Those were the days. After school, I'd camp in front of the TV with a jelly sandwich and some Mojave Popsicle. One bottle produced Richter scale belches. Two got me drowsy. Three and Elmer Fudd made sense. Things came to a head when we started sharing our brew. It's a little hard to hide root beer gone bad when your Cub Scout den goes home hammered. It didn't help that the bottles sometimes detonated. It happened once in our luggage on a road trip. Another time a top flew off as I was picking up a bottle and I got a black eye for a week.
So if this, you earlier in the column you explained that this was a recipe she got from her dad. So I'm wondering if the recipe made it into your hands.
No, it didn't. My mom is a very creative person. She was always experimenting with stuff. And sometimes it paid off, but a lot of times it didn't. And this is one of those.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Public Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Jennifer Napier-Pierce will be back on next week's show. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio.